continuing now with unhealed wounds. But it was 1982, before the connections between the Palestinian left and the Nazi right resurfaced anew, and once again, Jacques Berger was a principal player in the drama. So was his old friend, François Genoux. The case concerned the Paris trial of two terrorists known as the Friends of Carlos, unquote. Bruno Breguet, B-R-E-G-U-E-T, a 12-year veteran of pro-Palestinian terrorist action, and Magdalena Kopp, K-O-P-P, formerly of the Baader-Meinhof band, had been intercepted by the Paris police while carrying grenades and guns and 4 kilos of explosives in a borrowed car that was parked just off the Champs-Élysées. Jacques Berger was their lawyer and public apologist. Bruno Breguet had been on the terror circuit for more than a decade. In 1970, at the age of 20, the young Swiss had been sent by George Habash to plant a bomb in the Israeli port of Haifa. He was caught with dynamite on his person and jailed in Israel. But the most intriguing fact about the young left-wing revolutionary was that he became a protege of his fellow countryman François Genoux, a Nazi. Genoux later acknowledged his relationship with the PFLP. He corrected a journalist who had written that he had no connection, unquote, by saying that he, quote, had no particular connection, unquote, but had met Habash one or two times, again, unquote. In 1970, when the original Bruno Breguet case broke in Israel, Genoux, who was, in his own words, very available, traveled to Breguet's hometown of Tessin, Switzerland, to meet with the young man's family. Quote, they were lovely people, he recalled with the mildness of a fond uncle. I tried to help them. Help consisted once again of advice, unquote, and the recommendation of a young lawyer who later became Genoux's son-in-law. Quote, I was quite taken by the youth of this fellow citizen who had participated in this fair a little bit like a Boy Scout. At a time when so many young people didn't care about anything at all, he set off to do something interesting, recalled Genoux. According to Le Monde, Genoux paid for Breguet's legal costs and set up a support committee on his behalf. Given his relationship as a banker to the FLN, that's the Algerian Independence Movement, by the way, and his connections with Al-Fatah and the PFLP, providing such financing was perfectly consistent behavior for Genoux. Breguet was sentenced to 15 years in prison in Israel, but released after 7 following a vigorous publicity and lobbying campaign conducted by the Breguet Support Committee. His first free act was to visit Lausanne to thank his benefactor. Genoux was vague about their subsequent relationship. Quote, I've seen him a few times since his release from prison. Sometimes he sends me a postcard, he allowed. Bruno Breguet resumed his activities. By the 1970s, he too was involved in assisting the PLO in Europe through the Carlos Network. Let me repeat that last sentence. By the late 1970s, he too was involved in assisting the PLO in Europe through the Carlos Network. When the Breguet cop case came to trial in 1982, it was widely believed that François Genoux had once again paid Breguet's legal costs with money that had, after all, been earmarked for aid to the Palestinian cause. Breguet was a member of the PFLP, and Genoux was a longtime supporter of the same organization. Breguet had also lived in Berlin for a period during the 1970s, where he had easy access to the neo-Nazi groups that were dear to the heart of his benefactor. According to writer Claire Sterling, Genoux helped finance the Carlos Network in Paris in the early 1970s. 10 years later, it became evident that Bruno Breguet and Magdalena Kopp worked in the same network. In February of 1982, Carlos sent a letter to the French embassy in The Hague demanding the release of Breguet and Kopp. Quote, you have arrested members of my organization, he wrote by way of information. Carlos gave the French government 1 month to accede to his request, but the letter was leaked to the press, and naturally the government refused. There was no hard evidence to connect the events, but 4 days after the deadline expired, a bomb exploded on the Paris-Toulouse train, killing 5 people. The following day, the French Cultural Center in Beirut was damaged. On April 15th, a French military officer and his pregnant wife were shot at point-blank range when they opened the door to their apartment in Beirut. On April 18th, 2 bombs exploded simultaneously in Vienna, one at the Air France head office, the other in the garden of the French embassy. So recapping the significance of this, basically we have 2 associates, Bruno Breguet and Magdalena Kopp, European terrorists associated apparently with Carlos the Jackal, who we spoke about earlier, and they in turn are being defended by not only Jacques Vergé, but their defense is being financed by François Genoux, the post-World War II Nazi master, so to speak, or finance master, I guess would be a better way of putting it. Once again, we're going to take a short break, a short musical break, and then we're going to come back and finish up the section, this first section of the prepared portion for this evening. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. Well, good evening once again. We're returning to the prepared portion of One Step Beyond for this evening. By the way, my co-host Nip Tuck is ill this evening, and he is not going to be with us. In fact, I have a little bit of a head cold myself, so if I sound a little bit submarine, that's the reason why. Maybe he's got a worse version of what I have. Anyway, hope he effects a speedy recovery. And in the meantime, we will continue. By the way, speaking of broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. Returning now to the intersections of a number of different things we've been talking about, specifically the post-World War II Nazi underground and overground, in fact, and not only Palestinian terrorism, but as we're going to see now, other elements of supposedly left European terrorism. Continuing now with Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. Following the Breguet cop affair, Jacques Vergé became the lawyer for Mohand Hamami, that's H-A-M-A-M-I, and Frédéric Auriac, O-R-I-A-C-H, both members of the Paris-based multinational terror band called Direct Action, which was created in 1979. Hamami and Auriac were accused of breaking into an arsenal of arms that was under police surveillance. Auriac was also the editor of a glossy, anti-Zionist, anti-imperialist review called Subversion, a descendant of Vergé's seminal publication, Révolution, which was described as, quote, a political and theoretical instrument at the disposition of militant revolutionaries, unquote. Furthermore, according to Italian magistrates interviewed by Le Figaro, Hamami was at the heart of a triple connection: Red Brigades, Direct Action, and the Lebanese Armed Revolutionary Faction. A lot of interesting things in that particular passage, as short as it was. First of all, the fact that Direct Action, which is very much on the scene today, has been very active in recent months and years, has been represented as a leftist terrorist organization, that they should have this sort of connections to Jacques Vergé, an ambiguous individual, but a fellow who has documented connections to Nazi financier François Genoux. It's interesting that this Direct Action group should have that kind of a connection. Furthermore, the Direct Action would be linked with the Red Brigades is also intriguing. Of course, in our series, our Radio Free America series about the shooting of the Pope, we took a look at how Lizio Gelli of the P2 faction, the P2 Lodge in Italy, was credited with having a great deal to do with founding the Red Brigades. And of course, the Red Brigades have been instrumental in the so-called strategy of tension, which in turn has been it's been instrumental in driving the Italian public to the right. And of course, their terrorist strategy is very discrediting to the left in general. In fact, the Italian Communist Party has completely disowned the Red Brigades. Continuing now with the last section that we're going to be looking at this evening, from Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris, and again, further developments connecting the Palestinian terrorist movement with the elements, with surviving elements of the Third Reich, that is, surviving the end of the Second World War. By 1985, the alliance of the old-style fascist right and the new-style revolutionary left had become more visible. The seeds of Nasser's Cairo in the 1950s and the 1969 meeting of the New European Order in Madrid bearing fruit. In 1985, one of the left-wing Armenian terrorists defended by Jacques Vergé was found to be carrying a German passport that had been stolen by the neo-Nazi Hoffmann Group and distributed in a PFLP training camp in Lebanon. And in April of 1985, an important double arrest in Paris netted Odfried Hepp, H-E-P-P, the last member at large of the same Hoffmann organization, in the company of a Tunisian member of the Palestine Liberation Front. Hepp was suspected of having planned and or participated in the anti-Semitic attack on Goldenberg's restaurant in Paris in 1982. Hepp, however, claimed to be a member in good standing of the Palestine Liberation Front, Abu Abbas branch, with its base in Tunis. I'm going to read that last sentence again because it's very significant. This Odfried Hepp, remember, is a member of the neo-Nazi Hoffmann Sportgruppe Hoffmann, a very powerful and well-connected Nazi group in Germany. Hepp, however, claimed to be a member in good standing of the Palestine Liberation Front, Abu Abbas branch, with its base in Tunis. According to Arndt Heinz Marx, associate president until his arrest in 1984 of the neo-Nazi National Socialist Front in Frankfurt. Both Hepp and Marx trained in an El Fatah camp in Lebanon from July of 1980 until June of 1981 with a group of 15 German neo-Nazis. Quote, "I was a member of El Fatah, a fedayeen," said Marx. "El Fatah and the PLO are fighting for the rights of their people as we are fighting for the German people. The Palestinians and ourselves have the same enemy, international Zionism and the Jews." Marx added that the guerrilla training in Lebanon was not, that guerrillas training in Lebanon were not intended to attack Israel directly, but were preparing, quote, "for combat in Europe," unquote. As for François Genoux, his connections to both Nazism and the extreme left were evident and ongoing. In June of 1984, a Zurich newspaper pointedly reported that he had close ties with the Libyan embassy in Bern. Reading that last sentence again. In June of 1984, a Zurich newspaper pointedly reported that he had close ties with the Libyan embassy in Bern, and his own daughter, Martine, had been married to a revolutionary who was killed in an internecine battle in Lebanon in the early 1980s. A couple of comments about the last passage that we just read. One of the interesting things about the Nazi milieu that we've been discussing being connected with the Abul Abbas is that Abbas was connected, at least in the American press, and perhaps in reality, I can't say, but with the hijacking of the Achille Lauro in 1985. That was one of a series of terrorist acts that, completely dominated the American press in mid-1985, and which culminated in the hijacking of an airliner carrying the abduction, perhaps, hijacking, whatever you want to call it, of an airliner carrying some of the terrorists involved in this incident by aircraft from U.S. carriers with the 6th Fleet. They were forced down in Italy. So it's interesting to have these Nazi connections with the Abul Abbas branch, the group credited with the Achille Lauro hijacking. It's also interesting that in June of 84, a Zurich newspaper should report that François Genoux, the Nazi financier who's been front and center in this section we've been looking at, should have close ties with the Libyan embassy in Bern. That is an interesting connection, obviously, falls directly in line with the historical thread that we've been tracing here. Now, before we go back and review the section from Unhealed Wounds that we've been looking at,
that concludes the tape segment for tonight's broadcast. We're going to take a musical break, and then we're going to come back for some more information. And again, the information on that tape, a way of documenting the connections between international fascism, the Palestinian and Iranian terrorists that have surfaced over the last 20 years in the news media, and the, well, elements of the avowed left or ostensible left, such as Direct Action, Red Brigades, etc. Again, tonight talking about the fascist third position. We're going to take a musical break and then back live for more information here on One Step Beyond at KFJC.
Won't Get Fooled Again, another appropriate song, I thought, to some of the stuff that we've been talking about tonight. And in fact, we have talked about a lot of people getting fooled again and again and again.
Or is it still?
Or is it still, indeed. And we might want to just quickly reinterpolate some of the stuff on that tape segment for people for the articles that we're going to finish up with tonight.
Basically, we traced elements of the third position of fascism all the way back through the seminal Reinhard Galen mission to the Middle East. Now, recall that the fledgling government of Gamal Abdel Nasser wanted some expertise in order to put together its general staff and military intelligence service. It went to the CIA because of America's relationship with Israel. Alan Dulles, then head of the CIA, did not want to use regular CIA people. So we turned to Reinhard Galen, Hitler's intelligence chief for the Eastern Front during World War II, who jumped to the U.S. with his whole organization. And he took a bunch of Nazi war criminals, most of them affiliated with the Final Solution, and sent them over to form the Egyptian Intelligence Service, which they did. They also formed, under Otto Skorzeny, the first Palestinian terrorist groups in the Gaza Strip. They then went on to form the Libyan Secret Service, and that association, and we took a look at the association between Haj Amin al-Husseini, François Genoux, and Genoux was part of that mission. He was one of those German intelligencers who worked under the Skorzeny mission to the Middle East. So when we see Wahid Gorgi hooked up with François Genoux, it's worth bearing in mind just how far back many of these connections go. We talked about the Bandung Conference, at which the term Third World was coined, and these this Nazi Middle Eastern intelligence group played a key role in that conference in the form of Haj Amin al-Husseini. And again, that was by way of tracing the historical roots of this, perhaps for some bizarre-seeming association between quote, left-unquote Palestinians and quote, you know, Islamic fundamentalists, and people who, as that article by Kevin Coogan and Marty Lee would indicate, people who should, by all rights, despise people like that if, and here's the key, one is to take their ideology at face value. In fact, what we're really looking at here as we see the terrorist thermometer being turned up in the Middle East, and consequently, the patriotic slash military thermometer being turned up in the United States, perhaps to the benefit of George Bush and or others, the thing to bear in mind here is that this is really an application of what the Nazis referred to as geopolitics, courtesy of Karl Haushofer, and this is an application of what we're seeing today.
Indeed. Again, as we've talked about in the past, a lot of people who first started listening to these shows and other people's work in this field and talking seemed rather surprised by the idea that the United States, that bastion of democracy, could have spent the time at the end of and immediately after World War II gathering up scads of Nazis to import into our own intelligence and defense establishments. But upon a little study, it becomes fairly obvious why that happened. In the same way, that has had an effect on our national policy, and more than an effect, it seems to have been one of the determining factors in our national policy since World War II. In the same way, when you think about the primordial connections between the secret services of the Middle Eastern countries like Libya and Egypt and their early affiliations, in fact their birth out of fascist and Axis powers, it's not at all surprising, again, that the connections would still run so closely these days, and that, in fact, the nationalist movements in the Middle East would find it very easy to make contact and to work in conjunction with these self-same fascist groups that we've been talking about. We're going to explore a little more on that topic as we retreat briefly back into the mad whirl of the Mediterranean merry-go-round, but as we see, it also will have quite a bit to do with some of the things that are as current as today's headlines. And this also one of the articles for which we are grateful to our Italian translator, Dave. The article is originally printed in Il Messaggero for March 17th of 1987. And it's about the Giuliani Group, a very interesting group that we're going to be talking about in the next few articles. It says, the Giuliani Group, made up of about 30 young men active in Rome between 1972 and 1982, is an anomaly in the annals of terrorism. They operate against the system to the accompaniment of robberies and explosions. But here's the novelty. They have a foot in the ultra-right and a hand stretching toward the guerrillas of the left.
In the context of our broadcast here, perhaps novelty should have been in quotes.
Yeah, it's not much of a novelty for what we've been talking about at all. A foot in the ultra-right and a hand stretching towards the guerrillas of the left. It's based on the theory that, quote, if there is only one enemy, divisions make no sense. In short, a theory something like the old Nazi Maoist ones espoused in the late 60s by Franco Freda, but adapted to the rebellious climate that, after 1977, had infected all neo-fascists.
Recalling that Franco Freda was one of the Iranian-linked Italian fascists that we took a look at in the very first article at NIP-RED, you and our Italian translator Dave researched.
That's right, and when Franco Freda had said, when you are anti-Soviet, anti-American, anti-a variety of other things, that Khomeiniism begins to look like a real serious alternative. Now, what we're talking about, when he says anti-American, Franco Freda is talking about anti-democratic, which is not necessarily the same thing.
Although, I think one of the things to be borne in mind, a lot of these fascists do hate the United States because of the what they view as America's betrayal by not backing them in their anti-Bolshevik crusade. But the thing to bear in mind is that these are foot soldiers. These aren't policymakers, and that not only American policymakers, but specifically those who are linked with some of the string pullers, some of the behind-the-scenes manipulators, like the Galen people, von Bolschwing, François Genoux, can use people like this precisely because they hate America. They can be used to attack NATO bases, and they have, as indicated in the Erna Paris segment there. And then, of course, it can be blamed on, you know, the International Peace and Violence Brigade. You know, it's a perfect provocation. But if the foot soldiers really do hate America, they can be very, very useful, what is known as a useful idiot in the intelligence parlance.
That's right. There are always those who are being manipulated unconsciously and others who are consciously allowing themselves to be manipulated.
Remembering an article that we looked at concerning an article about the French treatment of agents provocateurs called Cherchez le provocateur, and there's an old adage on the French right that it's always a good idea to let a few shops burn.
Indeed. Okay, speaking again of the idea that, quote, if there is only one enemy, divisions make no sense, and Nazi-Maoist philosophies like those espoused by Franco Freda, Il Messaggero continues with the following quote, quote, the attack on Honeywell, this was an attack on the Honeywell Data Processing Center, basically caused an extreme amount of damage to the information processing ability of a large portion of Italy at that time. The attack on Honeywell was claimed, meaning proclaimed, in a leaflet written in the language of the left, unquote. That's how Laura Lauricella, a 27-year-old penitita, or reformed, in Rebibbia prison, recalls the most serious action carried out by the Giuliani group. In other words, it works real well when you cause a destruction of this kind, like the one wreaked upon the vengeance wreaked upon the Honeywell operation, and then call in and proclaim the language of the left in taking credit for it. Continuing on farther down in the article, again talking about this Giuliani group, and what of their contacts with the ultra-left? After his arrest, a militant of the Fighting Communist Union, Antonio Ginestra, told of being approached by members of the Giuliani group, who proposed an assault on a military van, the expected booty, $1.5 million. Okay, again, now the Fighting Communist Union, we've been talking about the Fighting Communist Party earlier.
Fighting Communist Proletariat, because these are confusing names.
Indeed. The PCC, we talked about earlier. Now we're talking about the Fighting Communist Union, or the UCC, a very interesting group. But just so we can put the UCC in the proper context, they're talking about this Giuliani group with admitted ties to the ultra-right, also approaching the Fighting Communist Union, a supposed ultra-left group, although, as we'll see, that's in question, and asking them if they wanted to join in an assault on a military van for presumably pecuniary gain as well as perhaps some political gains.
Now, one of the main escapades of the Fighting Communist Union, the UCC, as opposed to the PCC, the Iranian-linked Red Brigades group that also assassinated Senator Rufili, member of the P2 Investigation Commission, the UCC, one of their most famous escapades was the assassination of Licio Giorgieri, an Italian Star Wars general. Reading now, and again, research and translation credit, as for the other articles, goes to our Italian translator, Dave, who's gone through, as I indicated at the top of the broadcast, a great deal to bring this information to us. This from the Corriere della Sera, excuse me, the Corriere della Sera for June 12th of 1987. The magistrates looking into the UCC's murder of Licio Giorgieri returned late this afternoon from a 3-day top-secret mission. Yesterday, judges Rosario Priori and Domenico Sica stopped in Istanbul, Turkey. Some have connected this last part of their trip with a resumption of a course of inquiries opened by the revelations of Mehmet Ali Ajah. So obviously that's a speculative connection, but it is an interesting place for somebody investigating the Red Brigades and a Red Brigades assassination to have stopped. Are too many Red Brigades in Istanbul, Turkey, or are there? Perhaps Mehmet Ali Ajah has revealed more than we have learned.
And again, for those of you who tuned in late or who are somewhat bewildered by the barrage of names, remember one of the key players, if not the key player, in the assassination attempt on Pope John Paul II, Licio Gelli, Grand Master of the P2 Lodge, not only through many connections intimately connected with Mehmet Ali Ajah, the man who tried to kill Pope John Paul II, or at least took shots at him, but Licio Gelli himself, also one of the founders of the Red Brigade, so not a surprising connection. Another not-so-surprising connection, unless you believe the public speeches of these various left- and right-wing groups, but if you've begun to look underneath the covers, as it were, to see what strange bedfellows might be found there, our next article, also one of our Italian translations from Dave, will not particularly surprise you. It's from the La Repubblica for February 16th of 1984. And it says, it's just a short snip, it says, in a couple of Red Brigade's bases uncovered in Venetia, investigators found newspaper clippings and photographs of Judge Carlo Palermo, head of an investigation into the arms and drug traffic. We might add, Judge Carlo Palermo was one of the key players and certainly the most discussed and the most public of the investigators of Stibom and the P2 Lodge scandal. Again, the Red Brigades, a supposed leftist group who, if one would...
if we could see Licio Gelli as a leftist, they're a leftist group.
Yes, if one would take them at face value, one would think, what better thing that the Red Brigades could hope for if they're truly leftists who want to smash the state than to see the P2 revelations come to full flower and show just how corrupt the government actually is? Well, we already talked about one leftist group being involved in the slaughter of Senator Rufili, somebody investigating the P2 and other related scandals, and now we see that the Red Brigades was apparently stalking or considering stalking Judge Carlo Palermo, the head of the investigation into those self-same scandals.
And interestingly enough, just as the Pope shooting trial was getting underway under Judge Martella, Carlo Palermo, who had recently been transferred to a very precarious judgeship in Sicily, in a very mafia-active part of Sicily, where his predecessor had been killed by the mafia, narrowly escaped assassination by a very powerful car bomb just as the Pope shooting trial was getting underway. Now, remember the Fighting Communist Union, that's the UCC, that assassinated Italian Star Wars General Licio Giorgieri and that may be connected with the Grey Wolves, Mehmet Ali Agha, etc. Remember that they were hooked up with the Giuliani Group, okay? Because now we're going to see the Giuliani Group hooking up with the Red Brigades in an indirect sort of way, or a complicated way, I should say, not indirect, and with the Stibom Arms for Drugs ring, so, and or people connected to it.
Buckle your seatbelts, folks.
This is sort of a tortuous article because this is based on information presented by a fellow named Mino Pecorelli, who was, as the article indicates, deliberately equivocal in the way he expressed things. I guess he did not want to get the Bakir Chalenk, Michele Sindona prison breakfast. That, folks, is toast with Licio Gelli. A lot of people in Italy, as well as the United States, who begin revealing interesting information have a way of experiencing suddenly failing health. And so perhaps he's being deliberately equivocal here in order to remain deliberately alive. Again, research and translation credit to our Italian translator, Dave. This from Panorama from June 12th of 1988. And yet, just in relation to the imprisonment of Moro, that of course is Aldo Moro, assassinated former Italian prime minister, killed by the Red Brigades, and yet just in relation to the imprisonment of Moro, someone high up had to know. One need only read again the top informant Pecorelli, who often got his news from the Secret Services. In the OP issue of October 17, 1978, when the importance of Via Montalcini, M-O-N-T-A-L-C-I-N-I, was known to everyone, Pecorelli wrote in his typical elusive style, quote, "The Minister of Police knew everything. He even knew where Moro had been held prisoner, in parts of the ghetto, drunk, end parentheses." The article goes on. He wrote just like that, quote, "ghetto," unquote, three dots, and the word "drunk," in parentheses, as if to underline a message. What did he want to say? The Magliana district, M-A-G-L-I-A-N-A, the Magliana district, as one knows, is considered in Rome as the ghetto district, or more simply, as the ghetto. Enclosed in parentheses, the word "drunk," in the writing of Pecorelli, may refer to Montalcini, a Jew, and hence to the street that bears his name and is close to Magliana, another name that, as we'll soon see, has exceptional importance in this story. From whom had Pecorelli learned the name of that street? And why, back then, did he refer to that street, that is now known as the Magliana Trail? Unquote. I'm going to read the last sentence again, the last couple of sentences. Enclosed in parentheses, the word "drunk" in the writing of Pecorelli may refer to Montalcini, a Jew, and hence to the street that bears his name and is close to Magliana, another name that, as we'll soon see, has exceptional importance in this story. From whom had Pecorelli learned the name of that street? And why, back then, did he refer to the street that is now known as the Magliana Trail? Unquote. To answer, we must listen to another friend of Tony Ciccarelli, the man who, with his Polaroid, possibly entered the people's prison, unquote, in Via Montalcini. Tony Ciccarelli is spelled C-H-I-C-C-H-I-C-C-H-I-A-R-E-L-L-I. Continuing. Speaking before the magistrates this time is Osvaldo Lay, L-A-I, a Roman business consultant. He explains that, quote, "My friend Tony was well connected with notorious Roman criminals," unquote. Affirmation that Ciccarelli's wife, Chiara Zossolo, Z-O-S-S-O-L-O, was talking explicitly about the Magliana Band, the powerful organization of arms and drug traffickers who had contacts with terrorists and the Secret Services. "My husband," says Zossolo, "knew Danilo Abruciati well. one of the heads with Domenico Balducci and Egidio Giuliani, that's from the Giuliani group we referred to earlier, of the Magliana band, killed in 1982 while attempting to assassinate the ex-vice president of Banco Ambrosiano, Roberto Rossone. Balducci is the man of Magliana who, pursued by the police of central Italy, traveled without fear in Secret Service planes in the course of mysterious operations. Well, Balducci and Abruciati are also affiliated with the Stibom Arms for Drugs ring, and obviously so too is another member of the so-called Magliana group, Egidio Giuliani. That's the fellow who's hooked up with the Fighting Communist Union, the UCC, that we looked at just a couple of minutes ago. And again, this is a tangled and tortuous web. It is the Mediterranean merry-go-round, but it is interesting to see this continuing pattern of the joining together of elements of the ostensible left and the right, who form a community of interest and in all probability are really indistinguishable.
And just to put some of this back into the necessary perspective, as Dave mentioned, the Michele Sindona prison breakfast, there are people who are capable of dishing out the prison breakfast, and very few people want to take the prison breakfast. And at times like that, when there's some question as who's going to be eating breakfast and who's going to be paying the tab, it's good to let people know that you know the chef. And Licio Gelli appears to be doing just that right now. This article, was this also one of Dave's? I didn't...
You got that too, yeah.
All right. From the Swiss Journal, which is an American... it's a newspaper about Swiss matters, but it's not from Switzerland, not printed in Switzerland. It's for May 18th of 1988, and the article is headlined, Gelli's, quote, revelations chill hearts of top Italians. Goes like this. Licio Gelli has started to talk, an event which, in prospect, was said to be chilling the hearts of many of the top people in Italy. After being extradited from Switzerland in February, then released from prison last week, the 69-year-old Grand Master of the P2 Masonic Lodge has begun to state his public defense against a host of charges ranging from involvement in neo-fascist terrorism to huge bank fraud. On Thursday evening, Mr. Gelli appeared on the main television news program to assure the nation that he was enraged by accusations of involvement in the bombing of Bologna Railway Station in 1980, which killed more than 80 people. He had committed no crimes and in time would reveal all that he knew about the scandals and outrages with which his name had been associated, he said. Yesterday, La Repubblica published a full-page interview with the Venerabile, who confirmed the impression that he is in tip-top form, despite what is alleged to be a serious heart condition. He skillfully revealed nothing of great substance, but, by scattering famous names like confetti, may have further lowered the temperatures of other, even more celebrated hearts. He confided that he had hidden abroad the 500-page testimony of Michele Sindona, the Sicilian banker who died of poisoning in an Italian prison 3 years ago. He also believed that another of his friends, the late Roberto Calvi, the chairman of Banco Ambrosiano, who masterminded the melting away of millions of dollars of the bank's funds, had been pushed into suicide. He himself had not even cashed a check with Ambrosiano, said Mr. Gelli, let alone taken possession of any of its funds. The millions in his Swiss bank account were his own, and he had offered to lend Calvi money, thinking that, quote, perhaps Roberto could do with $200 million. He laced the interview with references to people with whom he had taken coffee. Flaminio Piccoli, a past secretary of the Christian Democrat Party, who denies ever meeting Mr. Gelli. Mr. Bettino Craxi, the Socialist Party leader, whom he says he met on several occasions, although Mr. Craxi claims they had only one encounter. He further claimed exchanges with the former prime minister, Mr. Giulio Andreotti, now foreign minister, and says he presented a plan for the, quote, rebirth of Italy in the 1970s at the request of then-president Giovanni Leone. Was he involved in talk of a military coup? Many of his friends had been generals, said Mr. Gelli, but, quote, Italian politicians can sleep easy. There will never be a coup in Italy. We don't have any generals, just empty uniforms. Mussolini was right. Quote, it is not difficult to govern the Italian people. It is useless. Unquote. Again, Mr. Licio Gelli, a man who knows just about everything and can be reliably thought to probably be imparting about one-tenth of what he knows in terms of the truth factor of what he talks about, but probably pushing a great deal of buttons that most of us don't even recognize, even in the untruths that he is putting forward.
It should be noted, too, that if Licio Gelli ever really decides to unburden himself, he's going to shake loose a lot of pegs here on this side of the Atlantic as well as over there. Because, again, with the Billy Gates scandal involving Michele Papa, Gaddafi's representative in Italy, and others, we see the P2 nexus operating in a big way in the United States. And again, Dave got us some fantastic articles about Michele Papa and some of his activities with Palestinian and Middle Eastern terrorists, so we won't have time to go into those today, perhaps next week. We'll continue with the politics of the third position of fascism next week. Now,
bingo. And with that, we are going to say goodnight, and we will see you next Sunday at 7 o'clock. Until then, thank you for joining us. This is Nip Tuck and Dave Emery saying, broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC, Los Altos Hills.